Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be bringing you today's webinar on how to make sure you're not the next agency to suffer a data breach. The accounts receivable management industry has been in the crosshairs recently following a data breach that exposed the personal information of more than 25 million individuals. Today, you'll learn where vulnerabilities exist and how hackers are exploiting them, as well as valuable insights into data security, including how clients are holding their vendor partners more accountable for their information security practices. This webinar is being sponsored by TechLock. You'll get the chance to hear more about them throughout our program today. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speaker. Steve Akers is TechLock's Chief Security and Technology Officer, where he leads the company's consulting division. He joined the company in 2019, bringing more than 20 years of experience as a serial entrepreneur in cybersecurity and managed security services. Steve previously worked as the Chief Technology Officer for Change Dynamics, where he oversaw the research and development of its behavioral analytics security platform. Additional experience includes leading a team of security consultants at TrueArc and growing managed security services at NetRex, which later became part of IBM Global Security Services. Prior to working in the private sector, Steve served in the U.S. Army, the Military Police Corps, the Special Investigations Unit. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from Steve. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as his presentation is ongoing and when his presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net webinar recordings page. With that, let me hand the microphone over to Steve to begin his presentation. Steve, take it away.
Thank you very much, Mike, and welcome everybody. Appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to spend with us. As we'll go through this, you'll find I try to make this as informative and interactive, and I know I'm not standing in front of you, but I assure you I am pacing around my office because I like to do that. I want to be able to present some information today, as Mike talked about, as we're going along. If you have questions about anything, please don't hesitate or wait to the end. They can be helpful to other people that might be, might be also listening in, inside of this. So as Mike kind of talked about, quick from a, background, again, at TechLock, I'm the Chief Security and Technology Officer here. I'm a veteran. I was part of the U.S. Army Military Police Investigations Unit, which is kind of a cool unit to be. You get to do some kind of interesting activities within the military when you're in that unit. I've been doing cybersecurity for over 20 years as a consultant, assessor, a QSA, ethical hacking, etc. Lots of different client organizations, all different verticals, and really why that's important is because it allowed me a lot of time to get a vast view of what's happening out in the security and compliance landscape, whether that be a small organization, large, whether that be multinationals, local organizations, et cetera, and really bring a lot of that information, experience, what I've seen work, what I've seen not work, into these kinds of conversations. So excited to leverage that today. From a quick agenda standpoint, one of the things I like to start off with in these kind of sessions is really talking about foundation, counts, and stats. People always like that kind of information. And it really will set us up for kind of continuing our conversation to talk through a number of the threats and risks that are out there. A considerations exercise. So sometimes people ask me, so what do I do? How should I be evaluating some of this stuff? And so we kind of go through this considerations exercise, certain questions and ideas that you may want to talk about internally within your environment and your organizations that can help you make some decisions about how you might go about addressing some of these problems. And then we'll get into some real specifics around what can you do organizationally and technically to address some of the threats and risks that we've talked about. And then, yes, we'll open it up for questions at the end. But again, along the way, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to go ahead and drop them in, and we'll be glad to ask them in line. So coming up here on the screen, these are all organizations that we've seen or heard about, right? And the number below them is how many individual records were disclosed. And the interesting thing, there's some commonality, you know, when we go back and we look at these particular organizations inside of there, but the numbers are certainly large in terms of the total number of records that have gotten disclosed or as part of any particular breach. But one very important thing about all of those organizations is that at the time, all of them were compliant, whether that was with PCI or HIPAA or HITRUST, or they had been approved in terms of some type of SOC level external audit as part of that. And so every one of those organizations, because of the vertical that they're in, the types of data that they handle, were required to go through this compliance activities. But every single one of them yet found to be compliant also resulted in some particular type of breach. One other commonality across all of those businesses is that they all survived, right? Every one of them is still in business and still operating today. You know, my wife would, you know, if Target had gone out of business, she would have not been very happy about that that experience. And so, you know, from her standpoint, I don't know that she slowed down at all or even hesitated as part of that. But when we take a look at some organizations that were maybe a little bit closer to home, and so this was many, many years ago and really was kind of the precipice of kind of these big data breaches and records breaches. There were an organization called Heartland Payment Systems. And I mentioned them because while they weren't specifically in the ARM industry, what they were doing is they were, you know, a third-party service provider that was going out and providing services for payments, right, related to card, you know, information. And they had a pretty substantial breach, obviously, that resulted in 134 million records, you know, getting disclosed. But the interesting thing about them is at the time, they were PCI compliant. Their third party evaluator had come in and actually had certified them that, yep, they were in alignment with the particular standards. But one that obviously is really close to home most recently is with AMCA. Now, I don't know the specific status of AMC's compliance standard. You know, that hasn't necessarily been released that I've seen yet at this point. But one of the things that we can be assured about is that given the industry that they're in and given the industry that TechLog provides a lot of our services to, we reasonably assumed that they were going through a similar process where they were also needed to be compliant with certain types of compliance and regulation standards. But when we start looking at them, a couple things that are common across these two, both of them filed for bankruptcy. And unlike my first set of organizations that got breached, both of these organizations were really third-party service providers, right? So they were being asked to provide services to another organization. And then as a function of providing that service, they ultimately, you know, with the breach, ultimately had to file bankruptcy, you know, as part of those activities. Now, if we look at specifically with AMCA, one of the very interesting things about them is that, and Mike just mentioned this earlier, right, over 20 million records were breached as part of that activity. Now, the interesting stat, or a couple of interesting ones here for me, is that the middle one, is that the bad actor had accessed that organization and had been inside their environment for 240 days. And that's substantial, right? That means that once upon being breached, it was 240 days where somebody knew what was happening and was able to now start taking some sort of action, you know, based on that. That is forever. To a bad actor that's in your organization, you know, that amount of time really allows them to probably accomplish pretty much any objective that, you know, that they have. $4.2 million was spent on breach response and notifications, at least the last time I saw the stat. And there were basically five current legal actions kind of being taken against the organization at this time. And so that's substantial, right? And the reason why we bring up, obviously, AMCA is because of the target audience here, is that as I've been talking to more and more people, one of the things that this exposed, right, was the opportunity for a substantial amount of records within our industry that we've been providing services to, right? This is basically the bad guys saying and telling each other, hey, there's this gold mine of third-party service providers that have access to this kind of information, and they might be ripe for the opportunity. And so prior to really this, ARM industry really hadn't gotten so much on the radar from a hacker or bad actor standpoint. But this breach really changed that landscape. And I'm not a fear tactic person necessarily. What I more mean to educate people about is that there's a trend that it continues to happen with the bad actors, is that when they see opportunity, it is kind of like that blood in the water. And so with AMCA being a target and now being on that radar, there's likely to be, you know, a continued effort to go after people that are specifically within this vertical. So here's some other really cool stats, because I think it's important. Most of the time we interact with organizations, you know, TechLock, you know, no different, right? When we go out and we interact with our customers, compliance is foremost, right? They focus on that particularly. But when you look at the stats, there's some interesting ones that I'll kind of hone in here with the story. So first I got to talk about is that most people understand that, hey, they've heard the phishing and the emails and those particular activities, but you know, 92% of malware is ultimately that gets into the organization is delivered via email. And so, which means that for anybody that's on the phone, email is going to be one of your largest single targets. And the primary reason for that is the second statistic, is that the bad guys know that if I send enough information out, I send enough emails out, that 12% of that population, 12% of the emails that I send out, those users, are actually going to click on links in that data. And so as the bad actors have figured this out, they've gotten more and more sophisticated in terms of the way that the emails look, the format, the structure, the English that's used, or whatever the local language happens to be. They've gotten really particular to make sure that they appear and they look and they sound. Internally here, you know, at the organization, we run through a number of different social engineering campaigns, et cetera. And I was talking to one of our other security people here the other day, is that in the exercise, I got one in my inbox that I looked at and I was like, and it was the topic was something that was particularly interesting to me, something that I go and research, et cetera. And it almost caught me for just a second. And so I stopped, but they're getting so good at those exercises inside of there. So we'd mentioned the dwell time or the how long within AMCA that the bad actor had been focusing in, around 240 days. The average dwell time amongst breaches is just under 200 days. Again, dwell time meaning how long that a particular bad actor is operating within an organization before being detected. Now, that doesn't mean they've been removed or eradicated. That just means how long they've been functioning inside the environment before any particular detection happened out there. So, source of this data, one of the core things here is that SMBs are arguably the most vulnerable market segment. And a number of reasons for that is that sometimes they just don't have the same level of resources or sophistication, skill sets, et cetera, to really address some of these individual modern attacks. But one of the things, the next column of data is really the where I want to kind of focus in, because I think it's really important given that a lot of our customers and other people really seem to focus in on compliance, and we want to talk about that. So 71% of U.S. companies suffered some form of breach, right? That's a big number. That's not a couple companies. That's a lot of companies suffered some type of breach. 89% of that 71 were in a regulated industry. And why I mention that is because that means that if they were in a regulated industry, they were required to be compliant with some type of particular standard. Again, that might be credit card or PCI or healthcare related data with HIPAA and high tech or high trust, et cetera. They were regulated. They were forced to be compliant with some type of particular standard. Out of that 71%, 43% of them were SMB. And why that's important is that's telling you is that the bad guys are not just going after the large companies. They're going after the low-hanging fruit, those organizations that they feel ultimately are most vulnerable. And then 50% of the causes of breach were not covered by compliance. And what I mean by that is that the reason that the organization was able to be breached was not something that a particular compliance requirement would have addressed. And again, that's huge. And so these circles here on the right-hand side that I have highlighted is really kind of showing that there absolutely is some overlap between the two. But compliance is really a subset of security in the larger scope when it comes to protecting you from the bad actors, from breaches, from malware, et cetera, as part of that. And there's certain elements of compliance that aren't part of security, right? They are unique to that particular standard or regulation. But when you're looking at the larger landscape of security, there's a lot of elements that are part of the security program and protecting the organization, et cetera, that are simply not going to be addressed when you look at just a compliance-only perspective. So I get asked all the time, right, when I take Steve, what are the things that are happening? What are the biggest risks to my organization? What are they coming from? And I tell most people, I really try to break these down into kind of two views of the coin, if you will. The first one is the organizational risk. These are things that are typically more about awareness and perception on the organization in general. And so the first one is, I tell people a lot, is that, man, I talk to org companies routinely, and you'll be amazed, even, it doesn't matter the industry, but amazed how often that their head is just in the sand about really what's going on. They have this perspective that I've never had a problem, I've never had a breach, I've never had anything happen, and so it's never going to happen to me. Second one is that we'll get to the view is that, you know what, why would a bad guy come after me? And I try to tell people, I'm like, if you think about it, it isn't necessarily about coming after you. Even if we go all the way back up at the top and we talk about those big companies that had breaches, and a number of them, like Target as an example, the focus wasn't Target. It was Target-specific data or what data that they had access to. With the third parties, with AMCA, et cetera, it wasn't about trying to do damage specifically to AMCA or to the payment card or the payment organization. It was about saying, hey, we know you have access to these particular types of data. And so it really starts to separate out about being big enough or not. It's really about the kinds of data that you have access to. And there is certainly some aspect of that, them taking into consideration how much volume of data that you might come back to. But a lot of our current customers, I know who their customers are, and they're not small. They have some pretty large organizations, which really goes to that third bullet point. The data that we have isn't valuable enough. Well, it may not be your specific data, but it may be the data that you're processing, you know, as part of that. The second element in terms of organizational risk that happens a lot of time is that organizations, a lot of times, they underestimate the effort associated with properly protecting the organization. Clients, a lot of times, or organizations when we talk to them, they don't understand why it's really important to have operations that are protecting you on a 24/7 basis. Well, you know, the bad guys don't sleep. And frankly, the targets for most U.S.-based businesses are more often after hours than during business hours. And it's a real simple reason. They understand that a lot of organizations, especially in SMB space, once it hits 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever, and those people head home, nobody is watching anymore. And so if I know that as a bad guy, it's a natural path for me to go after organizations and do it after hours because I know my resistance is typically going to be lower or slower. The next bullet point there, underestimating effort, is that security is complex. And I'm going to go back here just for a second because I think it's important, is that I made these circles specifically the size I did because it is a point. Not to say that compliance isn't complex or compliance, it doesn't have elements to it that are hard. But the landscape of compliance is substantially much smaller than the threat landscape specifically associated with security. And so when we go and we look at that, I try to tell people, I'm like, listen, it is a complex thing, which means it's hard to stay up on. And a lot of the organizations and people that we talk to all the time are like, listen, you're producing the widget. You've got the specific things that you're trying to do. And in doing that, you're trying to, you know, that's your core business. That's where your focus is. And so if you also need to try to manage something as complex as security, you really need to evaluate, you know, kind of what's going on. And the last point organizationally is really just the lack of awareness in general. And what that means from the top, those people that are running and managing organizations, or all the way down through to the individual employee, right? How does security play out inside of the organization? Is it talked about? Are people understanding how they might help a bad actor or facilitate somebody doing something, even though that they think they're just trying to ultimately do the right thing for their job? On the right-hand side is some more technical threats, right, in terms of cyber threats. And what I've listed here really are the top five that are most common, either through an exploitation or path in which that are going after small SMB type organizations. And frankly, a lot of these are applicable to almost every organization. The first one is phishing. And so for those, I won't go through the massive detail of all the phishing types, but basically in most cases, phishing is more an email-based campaign where I'm actually using email and trying to lure somebody into clicking on something, going somewhere, providing additional piece of information that allows me then to use that, elevate my privileges, breach the organization, et cetera. It is arguably the single largest vector, but it is not the only vector, right, in terms of people gaining access to information. The second one is ransomware. And so this one is hitting small businesses more and more. And the reason for that is because ransomware creates a unique opportunity for the bad actor that didn't exist before. And so if you are an organization that is, you don't have access to sensitive data or data that has a monetary value in the black market, right? But you're trying to operate. So what really is important to you is your ability to continue to function. So the bad guys have figured out that, hey, if I can go into an organization and I can basically use that to, and I can use ransomware to then encrypt everything inside your organization and hold the access and the ability for you to operate hostage until you pay me a ransom, now it almost doesn't matter what kind of data that you have access to. So if I can impair your business unless you pay me money, they've seen that and more and more viable. And unfortunately, you know, organizations continue to pay the ransom. And the bad guys have learned, hey, if you pay the money, it is to their advantage to actually provide you the key to let you decrypt. Because then anybody else would know, okay, well, I know if I paid the money, they would let me do it. So ransomware is one that's really targeting in on the SMB business because of the value, and typically you don't have the same level of backup resources, et cetera, that might be available in somewhere else. Cryptojacking, I'm sure most people inside of here have heard of Bitcoin and the mechanism that's there as part of that. And so I won't go into the details of everything about Bitcoin, but there's this process that's called mining, right? That's basically going out and mining coins, and you use computer resources to go out and do that. And so the way that additional Bitcoins can be generated for a bad guy is through that mining process. And the way that they do that is what's called cryptojacking. And so basically what they will do is that they will come into your organization. They will breach you in some particular way. They will install a piece of software on your machines, workstation, servers, et cetera. And then that machine, the only purpose it has is to go out and do these mining activities unbeknownst to the user. These tools and technologies that you use for cryptojacking are sophisticated enough in that they learn the behavioral patterns of the user. And so they know, hey, 8 to 5, don't do this, because if you do it, it's more likely that I'm going to get detected in terms of eating up additional resources on the machine. So with this particular technology, they basically will most often wait till off hours, et cetera, and then they will turn up the activity and actually go out and do the mining activities that are there. Fourth bullet point here is one that I think most everybody here should be very familiar with: weak passwords. And so a very, very important point about weak passwords is that it is still a significant vertical problem that almost every industry suffers from. And so one of the elements that has been communicated for a long time, and unfortunately even some of the compliance standards really haven't caught up to the rest of the world in terms of, what the real impact is. But when you take a look at, individual weak passwords that are there, it's a couple important notes about those technologies when we consider them. So when you take a look at a password, and you can take a look at a password, most of the time we would communicate it about, or basically saying, hey, you have to have a certain level of complexity for that password. It has to have uppercase, lowercase, and specific characters. And not that it's a bad idea inside of there, but I want to try to educate people on is that the more and more stronger principle that's being communicated is about length of password versus the actual amount of complexity. So you could have a 16 character password that is just numbers only, versus an 8 character password that has all the complexity that we've used to, special character, uppercase, lowercase, all the numbers, et cetera. It will take longer to crack a 16 character password of all numbers than it would take to crack an 8 character complex password. So we encourage people to look at password length as being the more and more specific prevalent activity. Now, unfortunately, compliance standards haven't caught up yet, so you've got to kind of obviously meet the requirements. But as you're thinking through this and building policies, et cetera, certainly something to consider. And last one here is around.
Matt is getting that error message, Jeff. I'm going to call it in.
Somebody needs to mute. I'm hearing somebody.
Yeah, me too. Sorry about that, Steve.
The last one is poor application security. And so what we're looking for there,
trying to get onto the dialer.
is where organizations are using or building applications, or they're actually working with third parties on those applications, and they're just not built from a security standpoint. They're really focusing on the functionality. Maybe, unfortunately, they've been rushed, whatever the mechanics are inside of there, but that is certainly an area that is a common activity, and most of these applications are internet accessible, meaning that the bad guy can do so and continue to try to work on these applications, you know, almost unhindered to do those activities. Okay. So one of the exercises that, you know, we want organizations to kind of go through, and we call this kind of a consideration exercise. And I am the first person for everybody that's listening to say, hey, there's too many words on the slide, but I wanted people to have a takeaway. So I put some of this stuff on here so you had a data point for consideration. But I'm going to walk through some of these because I think they're really important. And this is specifically around making decisions about how you would address security, what some thought process that you might want to partake in as you go through this exercise. The first one is, within the organization, what is the perception around the degree of threats that we face, right? Do you actually believe that there is a threat, right? And that's an important one, because if you fundamentally don't believe that's the case, then obviously that's, there's a path that you're probably going to follow if that's not true. If you don't believe there's a threat and you're on this call, I find that interesting, because I would tell you that that's probably not the right perception to have, but it's an important one, especially if you're talking about awareness for the entire organization, that a lot of people maybe think, hey, nobody's going to come after us. That's probably one that you want to change. Is the particular threat that you have towards you, is it high, medium, or low? And people will say, well, how do I make that decision? And you really just kind of evaluate that and say, okay, based on what industry that we're in, the types of data that we have, et cetera, how much internet presence, how big we are. There's all sorts of variables that might take a look at that. But you want to just kind of step back and think about it. All right, what are the different kinds of threats that might go out there and be impactful to our organization as a whole? The next one, which kind of dovetails into that last bullet point, is what kind of sensitive client data do we store or process, and how much of it, right? If you only handled one credit card every day, et cetera, obviously that's a much different footprint than somebody that might handle hundreds of thousands of credit card data or healthcare records or whatever it happens to be. You know, do you have generic, easy to find data that many would just consider public? If that's the case, then most likely somebody's not going to come after you specifically for your data. You know, do you have access to or process credit cards or financial information? Do we store or use personal health related data in some particular way? Those last two are ones that now will elevate the potential exposure that you have. And again, the point here is not just that you might store that data, but you have access to it either directly or through your individual customers, partners, et cetera. You know, with some of our customers, they're really concerned about intellectual property, right? Do you have any that you handle, and what kind of it is? Is it client confidential data, design plans, M&A activities, whatever it happens to be? Now, IP or intellectual property may not be as applicable within the ARM industry, but certainly, you know, if there's other people on the phone that may know other industries around manufacturing, et cetera, you know, the design documents, the formula for Coke, those are very, very sensitive activities. And if you have access to that, that's something that would certainly be a consideration that you'd want to understand. Does this really happen or applicable to us? Now, next, you got to kind of sit back and ask yourself, is there a financial impact if we had a breach? And the short answer should be absolutely that there is, but then you're trying to evaluate, so in what case would we have downtime? Would I lose a customer inside of there? Would there be cleanup as part of that? You know what, do you believe that if a breach was happened, that there would be some type of financial ramification? And here we're not asking you to quantify what that ramification is necessarily. We're just saying, do you believe that there is one? If there was a breach, how fast do you believe that you could recover? If you sat back in an honest moment and asked yourself, sat down with your organization, the people that are managing things, et cetera, and said, hey, if we had some type of breach and we lost all this data or all this got encrypted, how would we recover? What would be the options? How long would it take us? Those are all really important things. And in that scenario, you know, would there be a financial impact? Would clients or prospects lose confidence in you if it got out that you had some type of breach, right, as part of that? Would they be able to go to somebody else to provide those kinds of services? The next one is really about spend. right? What percentage of my budget goes to security related, you know, relative to the risk? You know, if you have some type of large financial risk associated with, you know, your organization, you know, do you feel like, you know, that you're spending enough to mitigate whatever that particular risk is? If you have a high risk and you spend very little to mitigate it, is, you know, what does that mean for the organization? And so you've got to kind of step back and take a look at that and what that individually might mean. And I've seen all sorts of stats about what percentages of budget the organizations will spend. You know, you guys can Google the same as I can. You know, there's a lot of different individual variables out there. But I try to tell people is that you really got to step back and look at the, your footprint, go through this kind of evaluation and kind of start using that as a basis. Do you sit back and think, hey, am I spending enough? I'm not here to tell you what that right number is because it's not the same for everybody. But are you sitting back and saying, hey, I've got a warm fuzzy about everything that we're doing and I think I've addressed everything that we need to address? Which goes in our next one. Does security meet our needs, right? You can look at it and say, you know what, based on this conversation and listening to Steve and talking through some of these threats and risks, I'm not sure it helps us or meets what we're really trying to do. It's okay. It's good enough to meet any regulatory requirement. But as I mentioned to you guys earlier, is that really the watermark? Is that the goal that you're trying to shoot for? It shouldn't be. You should be trying to shoot for security view, a much deeper security perspective than a compliance one. And can we do both? Hey, if we spent this or made this additional investment, I think we can meet not only our compliance requirements, but we also can improve our security as well. That is the goal. That is the target. If you achieve that, you're going to be in a very, very good place. And last place for considerations. Do you go, when you start looking at addressing security, one of the things you kind of have to ask yourself across the board is that do you have the specialized security skills or expertise? What technologies do you need to maintain or manage, right, organizationally? I mentioned this earlier. Do you feel like based on what you do, all the individual considerations that are in the previous couple slides, do you feel like you need 24/7 or not? Again, guys, I'm not trying to say you do or you don't. I'm just saying these are things that you should consider as part of kind of going through that process. Do you know what it costs you today to manage the tools and technologies that you have in place? You know, is the management of those sufficient? Do you feel like, you know, do I have multiple tools and technologies that my guys and gals are out there trying to maintain? You know what, how much time and effort do they spend doing the security side of this activity? And is that sufficient to do it really well? You know, it's one of those considerations. Again, you kind of look at it, organization evaluate. And the last one here, am I adapting and maturing to that changing cybersecurity landscape? Are things, am I being kept abreast? Am I aware of what's happening out there? You know, I wish I was in a room and I could see your hands raised, but I would sit there and ask, you know, anybody on the phone, are you running just straight up traditional antivirus technologies? If you are, and I'm not going to name specific brands because we don't need to do that, but if you're running a product that's really focused on antivirus and only on your endpoint, I would tell you that you are definitely inadequate to today's modern threats. And so then what do you do about that, right? What's your path inside of there? So you really got to kind of step back and take a look and decide, you know what, how am I managing this adaption? You know, what am I doing in terms of people, process, and technology? Are they keeping up? And how do you know, how are you measuring that you're keeping up or not? And then ultimately, you've got to evaluate options for risk mitigation, right? You got to, you can choose to accept the risk that's there. You can transfer it. Yeah, the most common method for that, right, we do in all of our other areas of life is through insurance and things of that nature. Or you ultimately are going to choose some type of mitigation strategy. And I put shared here because most of the time, if you're going to not do all of this yourself, you're really sharing the mitigation, you know, mechanism that's a part of that. And then you've got to look at, in terms of staff, training, and service provider, what are all of those are options of methods to help you with risk mitigation as part of that. So anyway, we'll make the slides available as part of this, but I want to kind of provide these considerations, things that we ask clients to kind of go through and ask themselves internally. I think that can be a really fruitful exercise to get the answers and make you feel comfortable about what really is kind of going on. So next slide is really around, okay, what can I do organizationally? What are the individual areas and things that I can do within my organization that can be helpful? So the first one, and I just touched on this, run through that considerations exercise to gain insight and draw some conclusions about your own organization. It can be a very helpful exercise. It might be enlightening to you when you hear the answers. And I encourage people to do that with other people, right, in the organization. Don't just do this yourself. Involve others and have the conversation about that, because you might get different perspectives that you didn't understand or didn't realize as part of it. Sit back and understand and recognize when expert help is needed, and that compliance and security are not probably in most cases going to be your core strength. It's okay. At TechLock here, yes, security and compliance, that is our expertise. That is what we do. But you know what? We use other organizations and other service providers for activities that where we go, you know what? We're not the best at this. And so, you know, like our managed service platform is hosted in AWS. You know what? They're really good at that. They're good at hosting that infrastructure and making it available. And so let's leverage that. That's not our core competency, what security and compliance are. And so just consider those activities. Lead by example. Make the cultural and awareness shift that you need to protect your organization and clients. It starts with individuals, especially those at the top, to evaluate and express what they're thinking about related to security and compliance activities, and that you're going to set the tone, you know, for those particular actions. And I tell people, you know, what are you specifically doing to ensure that your company stays out of the news, right? You have to be the source of that as part of that. On the right-hand side, and I underline this because this is probably one of the most important points. If you ask me, hey, walking away from this, what would I want you to understand is that treat compliance as a byproduct of security, not the source of your security, right? And too often organizations use compliance and they believe that that checks the security box. And I'm telling you that it does not. There are massive gaps in the approach, and we want to kind of focus in that. You know, and to that point, the next one here, recognize that compliance can't address threats that are posed by mistakes that people make, simple negligence, malicious intent inside of there. And you saw on the slide earlier, I talked about 50% of the breaches that occur are driven by things that compliance can't address. There's three right there that a great compliance program is never going to work through those activities. And those are the reasons why people have a lot of breaches, et cetera, is because simply those particular variables that are there. Consider compliance as the minimum, like getting a grade of a C. Beware of the checkbox mentality. And so, and what we mean by that is that, hey, I'm only being asked to do X, and so I'm only going to do X. And I understand that it's hard, because especially when you have to invest dollars inside of there. But again, we talked about some of these organizations, AMCA as an example. They checked X, certainly, and they had probably some type of checkbox mentality potentially there, and it didn't make a difference if they were only compliant as part of that. Avoid the can't afford it thinking. You know, and I tell people, can you afford not to? And this is not to say, hey, go spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on security. It's more to basically say, sit down, do the evaluation, and make a decision. Do you believe that you're spending enough? Do you believe that what you currently have in place is appropriate to protect the organization? And if it's not, then what do you do, right? You got to make some decisions about that. And next here is around some of the technically, right? What can I do technically, right? What are the things you can go through and implement that? So the first one I tell a lot of organizations is look at your current technologies, and do you believe that they're addressing the latest security issues that are out there? I mentioned antivirus earlier, right? If that's all that you're using as part of there, is that sufficient? No, it's not. Okay, well, what are my other options there? Work with your IT staff to understand their focus and where security falls in that picture. Hey, Bill, I know you're managing my servers and my switches and our internet and that stuff. Do you do much with security? Is this on your mind? You know, where does that fall? And get an understanding of that. Invest in awareness programs, training, routine phishing campaigns versus annual only. We talked about one of the largest cyber threat risks is going to be phishing exercises. So invest in things that are going to help you uncover and increase awareness organizationally on how those things are susceptible to you. And you need to do it on a recurring basis. I don't know the exact ratio, because obviously they don't publish that internally here, but we have routine campaigns that are happening at certainly monthly, if not more frequent than that. And so, because we recognize that it's something that can affect any organization. And I tell people, you know what, find a trusted cybersecurity advisor that's outside of your organization and meet with them, right? This does not mean that they have to sell you something. Sometimes it's just knowing some people. You know, I can't tell you our current customers, they contact and communicate with us routinely and they ask questions, and we want that to be the way it is. We want to be able to help and educate them and make this stuff available. You need to go and try to find somebody like that, that you feel like, hey, you know, can I run something by you? I heard about this thing. What does that mean? Why does this matter to me? And that could be very, very helpful. Proper access controls, endpoint security, and logging are key to both to prevention, detection, and being accountable. And what I mean by being accountable there is having a record of the actual activities that occurred. And if something were to happen, having the data available to give you insight into actually what happened to narrow this down. You know, I tell people all the time, when you hear about breaches, and usually if they very early, they get disclosed, they rough estimate how many records are there. And a lot of times what you're going to find in those exposures is that they simply don't know. They have no idea how many records. Because I assure you, if they could come out and say, yeah, we have all of the logging information that clarified only 100 records ever got disclosed as a function of this breach. Therefore, you know, we'll work with those 100 people or those 100 numbers or whatever and address it. You don't hear that. And the right reason for that is because they just don't have the appropriate accountability and visibility into what's really happening. And so that's why logging is a big data point there. I mentioned this earlier, enforce longer passwords, not necessarily more complex ones. While you have to meet your compliance requirement, I understand that, and some of them are very specific on what you need to do there. Just as you're thinking through your policies, et cetera, you may want to start looking at that. You're going to see a trend and a shift to start talking about things being more or longer than complex as part of that. If you're working with third parties in any particular way, ask, you know, have them prove their security and compliance. What are you doing to protect yourself and to protect the data or the services or the interactions that you're providing with me? Is somebody evaluating you, you know, as part of that? And that's that last one. Routine evaluation of your security and compliance controls. Right? Have an independent group come in and evaluate what's going on. That will give you more insight into what's really happening and try to have a focus not just on compliance, but have them say, hey, you know what? I'm also making sure that I'm doing the right things from a security standpoint. And if you've got guidance and recommendations on how I might improve that, you know, please include that versus just the traditional compliance checkbox. Okay. So I will currently leave this at questions that anybody might have.
Well, Steve, thank you very much. That was incredibly comprehensive and detailed. I really appreciate you going to the lengths and sharing some examples, because I think it really sort of hammered your point home. While we wait and see if we have any questions from the audience, and everyone's encouraged to submit their questions through the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Let me get the ball rolling with a couple. You know, the AMCA breach is a few months old now, and personally, I've been somewhat surprised that the industry hasn't been more scared or more focused on what happened and sort of responding. And maybe that's just me, because maybe I'm just not seeing it. But I'm curious if you have any observations on sort of how you've seen the industry respond in light of what happened with that data breach, and any changes that are being made. Are companies making enough changes or sort of responding the way they should be? Or is this sort of a case of, you know, what you were saying earlier, where everyone thinks they're too small and they're not on the radar and it's not going to happen to them?
Yeah, it's it is certainly a mixed bag. There are some of our customers, you know, we were at you know, the conference in San Diego, ACA, you know, kind of going through that, and we met with a number of different customers and prospects, and there were some that absolutely resonated with them, right? That they said, listen, I don't want to be that person. I understand kind of maybe how we got here. What do I need to do? But then you're right. Some organizations have kind of still fallen back. It's now in the rear view mirror and it's behind them. And so they're not focused on it anymore. And so, but one of the drivers there, and one of the things that I've been trying to advocate, is You're going to see this change and shift in how organizations are evaluated, where it's going to start becoming less of a compliant or not, and more a maturity level or not. And so now think of a scenario where, as an evaluator of why I choose one service provider over another, having a scenario where I can understand in that evaluation, hey, you are only, 72% aligned with the standard, where this other customer is 80, or this other, potential partner is 80. And so you're going to see this maturity view, and I think that will help. But you're right. It spikes when there's an activity event, and then it kind of, it wanes off, unfortunately, after that sometimes.
Excellent. Thanks. I'm also curious with regards to what you were mentioning about password strength. I think that's really interesting. Isn't it a case where a lot of companies are they don't set their own sort of password requirements? It's whatever payment processing vendor or collection software or skip tracing vendor. Those are setting the password requirements. Is this a case where you're saying that there should be more conversations between like companies and their service providers with respect to password requirements, or other situations that you can think of where this is a factor?
Yeah, no, it's you're absolutely there's multiple variables there and facets to that discussion, right? Is one, what can the technologies themselves support? Sometimes they support certain things versus another, et cetera. And so what I try to encourage organizations to do is saying, and I mentioned this a couple times when I was talking through it, one, you should establish what your policy is, right, that you would want to have in place. Okay, we're going to decide, and I know everybody cringes when I say this, we're going to have a 16-character password. But if that 16-character password could be a phrase, a literal English phrase, and not full of massive amounts of complexity, you might find that people are more likely to use that level of password because they're like, oh, okay, well, I can remember that. That's something that I can, I can use inside of there. And so, and then if that's your policy stance that you make, now can I then work to apply that and have that be done across, third parties, across other areas? So it's like, hey, we're using your technology, do you support these more complex passwords or more lengthy password, et cetera? If you can, great, I'd like to enforce that. And so you got to kind of deal with it, unfortunately, in some type of one-off scenarios, but it really starts internally and then working with your employees and staff, et cetera, to say, hey, when you're going out and using the applications that are, they are enforcing the password complexity, try to use something stronger. and here's some examples and here's inside of there. So yeah, you've got this dichotomy certainly of who's enforcing it, what the options and technical options are available. But that's why I tell a lot of people is really start with your policy, and then that will kind of help dictate or at least move you in the direction to start implementing them more and more when the opportunity arises.
I know a lot of people, myself included, use password managers. Is that something you advocate or don't advocate the use of?
This, I have this question asked, often. And so it's a mixed bag because, and here's why. The password managers can be really good in terms of allowing, of keeping track of a lot of complex passwords, right? You could decide, hey, I'm going to make this thing as long as a complex, et cetera. But then what happens then is that I will find with people in general, I won't say a customer in general, because typically it's a person specifically, then they'll make the password to get access to all the bigger passwords really easy. so it's like, okay, you kind of defeat the point. And so what I tell people, I'm like, if what you can do is you can take those kinds of technologies, and I'm specifically more talking about access to company assets more so than personal, right? Company assets, which I suggest people doing is say, listen, use them in those circumstances, but anybody that's going to then access that repository, make them go through some type of multi-factor. So you know that it's not a weak password that's the one thing, the one stopping point, the one gate to prevent a bad guy from getting access to everything. Make it multi-factor And so then you know, one, you have an accountability of it, and two, that it's a much more complex situation to get access to something that that has all the keys to the kingdom.
Got it. We have a question that came in asking about the future of passwords and wondering whether or not you think they're going to become obsolete at some point.
In the business world, do I think it will come that particular direction? Probably. But you're way down the road just because there's so many technologies that are out there. On the consumer side, what will happen is that you'll see shifts, right, where mobile devices will become more and more the mechanism to get you into resources, which then have either specifically they have multi-factor capabilities built into them, or you put your thumb on it or whatever. So it's becoming easier. The technology is catching up to allow a much easier distribution of those kinds of technologies. But you're talking to consumers here, right? I'm thinking, you know, I use my mom as an example, right? If my mom had to use her phone and a multi-factor to log into her banking application, she probably would never do it because she's like, I don't understand how all this all works. And so, but she knows right. how to put in her password. And so you'll see a trend though that will work to probably work towards that. So the short answer is, do I agree that it's probably coming obsolete? Yes. The question is where, what's the time frame? It's going to be a while.
Okay. Another question from the audience. Can you point to any resources for addressing the human element, namely training the least knowledgeable and or technical employees?
Yeah, there's a number of different technologies out there to do it, and they all kind of serve similar purposes, but just have different feature sets. So there's companies, one of the more prominent ones is called Wombat, like literally like the animal, Wombat. And then KnowBe4, so KnowBe4. They are a very prominent one as well. And so that's probably two of the most, the Wiley ones. And I think if I remember right, and I what I believe is that the Wombat actually at some point offered even like an open source or free. I put that in air quotes for those that didn't see me do that. I thought there was an option at some point. They might've gotten rid of that, but both of those are pretty prevalent. And depending upon what service offering that you provide, there's a number of different options that are there. And now most of those are going to be really focused on awareness and doing phishing campaigns. If you want other types of social engineering activities, then typically that's going to be a service provider, some sort of a firm that will provide those kinds of things. And I don't mean this in any way a shameless plug, but we do those things. But it doesn't, just social engineering alone does not address the awareness problem. And that's really where technology like KnowBe4 and Wombat can help.
Another question, sort of looking at companies in the credit and collection industry today, if you were going to sort of list the one or maybe two or three most vulnerable areas of a business, would you be able to sort of do that or sort of, if not maybe what the most vulnerable ones are, at least sort of point to some of the, you know, what you think are the most vulnerable areas?
Honestly, it's probably going to come back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of threats, right? That it's going to end up being, you know, having technology, et cetera, to address endpoint related activities, whether that be phishing or ransomware, et cetera. Those are going to be the two of the biggest targets. And, you know, I tell people, organizations all the time, is that you're going to do all sorts of awareness, right? Let's say you embrace it, you got all sorts of awareness and training and education. Even in my history of doing this, and I've had customers, large financials, where there is a financial incentive for employees or a financial penalty to the employees if they click on a known phishing exercise, right? And so in those organizations, they still will have a 2-3% click rate. What that means is that even with the awareness, and trust me, to go from a 10 or 15% click rate down to 2 or 3, you're drastically reducing the threat. However, the bad guy only needs one. That's where investing in technologies that can help you at the endpoint address with that particular type of issue, and stop it from ever taking hold. So you need both. Right, you want both kinds of sides of that, you know, sides of that coin. So the first ones would be training and awareness around phishing and ransomware, et cetera. And then secondly is going to be putting in technologies that help prevent that. And then, you know, from there, you've got some of the other ones that we talked about with, you know, application security and, you know, crypto jacking and some of those things, but they're, you know, they're typically going to be secondary or tertiary to, you know, those, probably those top two.
With regard to ransomware, which I think is really interesting, should, you know, it, should companies pay it if it ever happens to them? Should they not? You know, and I know it's, there's a lot of variables in there, and it's probably a whole other conversation we can have, but I'm curious, you know, it, you know, what sort of advice or, you know, or maybe sort of high level overview would you be able to give to anyone should they ever find themselves in that position?
Yep. So a couple really important things, is, just like, you know, I think we, most people probably have heard in the business world, and I mean, in general business world, the Me Too, right? So, so Acme Corp goes out and builds the widget. Everybody loves the widget. And then you have Me Toos that build similar widgets, right? So we've all heard that terminology. Believe it or not, that same principle exists even in the hacking community. And why that's important and where I'm going with this is if you ever find yourself in a ransomware scenario, absolutely involve authorities. It is it is massively to your advantage because one, I have absolutely seen scenarios where the Me Too group, right? They know that, hey, you're not educated about encryption. You don't know bit strength and key lengths and things of that nature. So you don't know what that means. And so they come and tell you, hey, if you don't give me, you don't pay, I'm going to have a problem. You're going to have a problem. So you involve the authorities who are experienced and stuff. I've had scenarios where they said, oh, yeah, this is the variant. We know how to crack it. We've got this is not the super advanced guy. This is some Me Too guy that built this, and we know how to address that. So it is to your advantage to involve them inside of there. Now, the pay or not pay, that is a big decision for any organization to make. The only thing that I can tell you is that the majority of the time, the circumstances that I've heard, when the ransom was paid, the encryption keys were taken care of, were provided, or the decryption keys were provided. The thing that I can also tell you is that if you don't have the appropriate controls in place, you cannot be insured that they won't turn around and encrypt you again at some point down the road. They're not going to do it the next day because then people learn that, oh, well, even if you pay for it, they turn around and mess with you the next day, right? And so they don't do that. But it is one of those things where you're potentially propagating the problem by getting involved. But I understand if your business is at risk and you're like, man, I can pay whatever, you know, $10,000 to have this done and I can move on inside of there. But if you did do that, you certainly want to make sure that you have the appropriate forensic expertise, et cetera, to ensure that whatever, however that person got in, whatever's running is no longer present, that it's been resolved.
Got it. We did another question about a ransomware. Is most ransomware being activated via email?
Most original things, yes, that is going to be the starting source. It's going to either be through email or through visiting sites that are, you know, a little more salacious, right, in terms of their content. And so in doing that, you expose yourself to opportunities because, again, they know that there's a high likelihood that I'm going to get a large volume of people to go inside of there. But it doesn't have to be. With the advent of malware that is being used inside of the advertising engines and things of that nature, they're getting really, really smart. And so, again, that's why I highlight the point of having some really good endpoint protection is a requirement to make sure that no matter what, even if somebody does accidentally click on something or go somewhere, that you've got the appropriate protection.
Of course, by salacious, you mean something like CNN or Fox News, I'm sure.
That's exactly what I mean, yes.
Well, we've reached the top of the hour. I did want to give you a chance, though, before we wrap up. Any other key – I know you've done a great job summarizing everything, but were there any other key takeaways or points that you wanted to make that maybe you didn't get a chance to before we wrap up?
I mean, it's just echoing the same one that I hope kind of crossed here is that compliance is not protection. And you need to be thinking at the protection layer. If you do security right, you should be able to account for the vast majority of compliance requirements, but it doesn't work the other way. And so just, you know, be thoughtful about that side.
Well put. Well, Steve, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insights today. You did an awesome job. I really appreciate your you taking the time to share with us today. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, everybody.
Everybody, thank you for joining us. Thanks again to TechLock for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.techlockinc.com to learn more about the company. A recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today, and I hope everyone stays tuned to the site for news and more webinars in the very near future. Everybody, enjoy your day. Thanks a lot.